So today's date, where are we? We're the
18th.
And who am I interviewing today?
Yeah, you're interviewing Betty McMahon.
What year were you born and where?
I was born in 1930 in Wollongong. And I was the youngest of four children, and so spoilt by my father, who was the manager of Texaco, now called Caltex, on the south coast. He was also the mayor of Wollongong. A civic responsibility was important in his life, and so in ours. The contrast with my father was my mother, who was very active and creative and loved sports, golf, tennis, riding. Arts and craft filled the house. Her attitude was everything is achievable, but her religion was the most important aspect of her life. We said the family rosary every night, and all of us belonged to some sodality in the church, Children of Mary or Prima Primaria or the altar boys or whatever. So we lived on, I think, 10 acres of land in an old ranch type house with a veranda around three sides. There were five bedrooms, and there was a room for a live-in help, an English woman, because the English people had come out looking for jobs during the beginning of the war. We rented out two dairy farms on either side of us, so I guess we had about 50 acres altogether. This is the present site of the Teachers College, the University, and the TAFE College in Wollongong at this moment. So the property stretched from Mount Keira down to the Princes Highway, and Mount Ousley Road was built through our property. When I started school at St Mary's College Wollongong, I suppose about the age of six, I don't know, and then when war was war had broken out in Europe, and my mother thought that when the Japanese joined the war, the first bomb that came would have McMahon written on it. So she sent me to a friend's place to live in Forbes, so I would be safe. I was the youngest. I ran away from that school and came back and found that, Mum found that King Copper Rose Bay had been evacuated here to Bowral during the war, and I came here to school. I loved school from the moment I set foot in it. The nuns were called Mother, and I loved that, and I felt I was loved and accepted. I have to say I wasn't always a good little girl. I talked too much, I think. When I reached grade six, all of us went to Rose Bay Convent, New South Head Road, Rose Bay, because you had to be a boarder to be at that school. I was impressed deeply by the happiness of the nuns, and I found their philosophy inspirational. I loved the prayers and training in meditation, and some subjects I found exciting, botany, art appreciation, and especially ancient history. In those days, the leaving certificate was the last exam, and I passed all subjects except music. I spent only a year at home, and then I entered religious life in February the 2nd, 1950. Teacher training and Victorian accreditation was gained for sub-primary and primary teaching in 1952 and 3. Then I taught at Rose Bay for a while, then sent to Braybrook in the western suburbs of Melbourne, and then back to Kerevere Park, and then to Green Valley.
Just wait till that dog stops barking.
Dog, it happens to be Isabella.
Is that your dog?
Yes.
And why is she barking, sister?
She wants to join in the fun, I suppose. There's something going on. You're not doing something here, are you?
Oh, it's just, yeah, well, I don't have any dog whiskers in the show or anything.
I do in my pocket. I just read Matthew Fox said that the best spiritual director is a dog. They're faithful, they're loyal, they listen to everything you say, and on occasions they obey you.
So talk a bit more about that. That's interesting. What are those?
I think that Matthew Fox was a priest, and he discovered that one of the first people to look at creation as being the awareness of God, that God in everything, finding God in all things, and God in all things. And so he had, at that his own time in California, a little dog, and he found that that dog was so aware of every movement that he made that he felt that was an image of God's awareness of us. Never out of sight, never out of mind, and that no matter how he came in, disappointed, happy, or frustrated, that dog just loved him. And he felt that that was a true image of God. And so then when you're looking for direction, spiritual direction, somebody you can talk to, somebody who'll listen, someone who is not judgmental, that's a spiritual director. And he felt his dog was his spiritual director.
And what does Isabella mean to you?
All of those things. You can always be sure of a welcome, no matter what time you come in. I think she's just an absolute delight. We all enjoy her. She's very intelligent. She got out yesterday and we couldn't find her and ran around and she was kind of let loose. But I rattled the keys of the car and called out, "Isabella, car, Isabella, car." And she came flying around this house and down to the garage and waiting on the passenger side to get in. And she's only 16 months old.
What sort of dog is she?
Maltese Shih Tzu cross. Very, very pretty. And called Isabella after Princess Isabella of Denmark. And Isabella being the favourite name for girls this year.
It's a beautiful little story. That's I really enjoyed that analogy. So I just want to take you back to around the inspiration of you joining the convent.
Mm.
So Kerava Park, where you... can I ask why you ran away, why you ran back?
Do I have to tell that story?
just explore it a little bit more, because it just reveals a bit more about... what you were like.
Hmm. I was living with these people and walking to school each day, and we were encouraged to go into the church and pay a visit before going to school. So I went in one day and the sanctuary lamp was out, you know, the little lamp that burns in the church. So I went up to Sister and said that the lamp was out. So at assembly, she said, "Oh, there is one little girl here who loves Jesus so much that she noticed that the lamp was out, and that has been relit. Now I want you all to be as attentive as she is." So I felt about 7 feet tall. The next day, I went in and the light was on, but I blew it out. And then I went and told Sister that the lamp was out. And so there was no comment at assembly, but I was waiting and waiting to be praised, but nothing happened. So the next day, again, the lamp was lit, but I went up to blow it out. And as I was in the act of doing it, Sister appeared and grabbed me. And for the first time in my life, I was caned. And so my brother, next weekend, came up. My brother was 10 years older than I was. And he came up to the Mackies where we were staying and said he was going to join the army and he was driving a utility truck. So I got in the back of the utility, and when he got back to somewhere like Bathurst to have a drink, I appeared and said I was hiding in the back. "I want a drink too." So he rang my parents and they said, keep coming. And so that's how I ran away, because I didn't want to be caned. You asked me about the difference at Rose Bay. Well, the sisters didn't touch us, mothers didn't touch us at all. They could certainly cut you down by words, but there was no active violence. And again, there was that atmosphere of encouragement. Like my mother, everything's achievable. And the nuns seemed so happy. Not that they talked very much, because they had a rule of silence, but when they did talk, you could hear the noise all over the school. And I think it was just that loving atmosphere, and that the sense of what I'm doing for you, Jesus does much more for you. There were books in the library by Archbishop Goodyear, and I used to read those each Sunday. We had to read, where you got to know Jesus as a person. And whenever I took that book, I was able to talk to one of the nuns about the parables or the miracles, and that kind of, I thought, whatever you've got, I want to have that too.
So do you have any of those books here?
No, Archbishop Goodyear, unfortunately, would be out of
print
now, and probably off the planet too. Well, here maybe even Berkelow's might have something like that.
So
there are three volumes, quite big, about the infancy, the narratives, the parables, and then each one goes through like the different parts of the sorrow, the mysteries of, I suppose, of Jesus' life.
And who was the author again?
Archbishop Goodyear from England. And if you read that, you were involved like in a mystery story.
So that's really, it sounds to me like that was the start of the journey of influencing you, your decision.
Well, I think that I wanted to be like the nuns, and this was the life that they were following, the life of Jesus. And that's what I wanted to do.
How old were you then?
I would have been from 12 till 17 or 18.
So let's talk about that journey into the convent.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you seriously contemplate?
I don't think it ever left me. On my first communion day, when I was at St. Mary's Wollongong, we were told that you asked for three things on your first communion day, they would be given to you. I even asked then that I would be a nun. But in my mind then, it was to be a missionary and look after the black babies and, have a really hard missionary life. And then when I went to Rose Bay, I found that there were sisters going off to the missions. We stood out on the front lawn there and waved off a couple of missionaries that went to Japan at the time when I was at school. So that desire, I didn't think I'd have black babies to look after, but I thought there is a chance that I can be sent to the missions.
Yeah.
Mm.
So that's...
That's one.
That's part
the
of
other
thinking.
Other thing, I think, was the care of the sisters. When you look at it now, it was probably almost like a concentration camp, because they never left us in the dormitory, sleeping with us at night. You know, the sister had a little alcove. Watching us at study, teaching us at school, watching us in the playground, playing sports with us. Of course, we were boarders. We often had special games, and the nuns played those games with us too. Hide and seek, it was called cash, but it was a certain kind of hide and seek. And so there wasn't a great leap between me as a child and the sisters.
Can we just talk about that hide and seek, what it was called again and why it was different?
Yeah. It was called cache, which is the French word for hide. And so in a you were in a camp, a group, and we were always in reds and whites. And so the reds would go and be with one sister, and the whites, whatever time, who was ever in, went off and hid. And we would hide in places that were not usually accessible to us at school, you know, in the tower or something like that, or in the underneath the sacristy tables and things. And the Reds then would send out four scouts, and they would have a time limit, and they would try and find in that time where we might be. And then the whole group, if they hadn't found it, the whole group would come and all stick together and try and find us. And then we had to race, get back, like, you know, in the hide and seek, all in the whippy. We had to get back into their home ground. And so we had nuns and children all squashed together in these little hideaway places. And it sounds like great fun, but what great fun was that the nuns used to argue a lot with each other and say, you didn't send out four scouts, you sent out six scouts, and we used to stir them up. We used to love to see them fighting with each other. They took it very seriously. And I think there was some reward for the camp that won. I can't remember that. Might have been cake of tea.
That's lovely. I like the red and white there. My ears are going mad.
Yes.
It's all making sense. Okay, so why was there so much observation by the nuns? That was just the care.
I took it as care. I see now that it was to make sure that, you know, you were not being over familiar with somebody or sleeping with them in bed or whatever, or that you were really studying and not playing solitaire, wasting time. But I see it as care, but I also thought it was, again, I want you to be the best person you can be in this situation, music or a study or play.
Okay, so you look like you're itching to jump into Green Valley, so will we do that? And we'll go, are you ready for that?
Yep.
Okay, so.
Can I move it?
Yes, move it all. Just give me the beat so I can cut in and out of the sound. So, okay, so you start with your script and we'll. And just put the paper down because it's blocking the sound waves. Just, you know, straight to
your voice. I know what you mean. Right?
Yep.
How are we going?
That's better.
Now don't make any movement.
Okay. Don't you
move. Okay, so, while I was teaching again at Braybrook and Kerevere Park, I gained a diploma in theology at Manly, and I did a business administration from Hemingway Robinson. And then because I received that award from Liverpool for a medal for work of education, the Catholic Education Office granted me a 3-year certificate trained. See, I was only 2-year trained teaching. And then I came to Green Valley, and I'd have to say I thought at the beginning I was the only green thing there.
Can we start about how the journey to Green Valley? Can I just interject?
Yep.
Let's talk about, as you know, Father Muldoon, let's talk about getting you to Green Valley.
Father Muldoon.
Process.
All right. Well, Father Muldoon came to Rose Bay, where the superior of the province was, and asked for some nuns to come and start a school. And a couple of nuns went with him out around the area. They looked at Villa Wood, they looked at Lunia, and they looked at Sadler. And the decision was made because at Rose Bay at that time had decided to take in day pupils. And because we're an international order, we had a visit from some Sisters from Rome. And they said we were duplicating services by having a boarding school here at Kerevere Park and a day school at Rose Bay. So Kerevere Park had to be closed, and was closed very quickly. They made that decision about May, and by December we had left here. And the idea was that we would go to a place that needed us more than duplicating services at Rose Bay. And Father Muldoon had asked, so they went out and then decided, yes, they would go to Sadler. He had a hall, and he had those four rooms that were for, I think they weren't classrooms to begin with. I don't think they were divided. They divided them into four classrooms. They weren't prefabs, they were tin, really. And they had come from an army camp. And he had a presbytery, and he moved into a little house in Gabo Crescent and gave us the presbytery to live in. And you'd have to realise that we were contemplative sisters then, with a rule of silence, and dressed in the old-fashioned way of sisters out there in Green Valley, with three layers of merino around us. And we had regular hours for prayer, for rising, for eating, and going to bed. And so we lived in that convent, six of us, in that his house, two in every room, and had the classes in those other rooms outside. And we could only, because we were enclosed contemplatives, we could only go to the church, which was the hall, to the classrooms, and to the convent. We couldn't move outside. We couldn't walk up the street. Later on, we got each year a class was added. So before we left that presbytery, there were eight of us living in those three rooms there. And when we moved over to the new convent, the school was then built on the rubbish tip, as you know. And then we went over to the convent. That actually coincided with changes in our religious life, with the changes from Vatican II. We then became, we were an international order, and there was a chapter in Rome, and it was decided we would not continue to be contemplative sisters, we would be apostolic sisters, which meant that there weren't regular hours for prayer and all together. It was each one's responsibility to do it herself. So it doesn't mean to say you didn't do it, but you carried out your ministry first, and then the prayer fitted into it.
Can I just, do you want to read what you've got there, or can I go back?
No, you can do it.
Okay, so you were talking about something about your first impressions, you were the only green, you just get your papers right and you settle down and then talk. So it's something about, you're about to say
yeah,
about.
I thought, my first impression was there were no trees, it was barren, it was hot, and I think the worst thing for me was the smell in the church, which was only a hall, had been used for housey on Saturday night, and the smell of the smoke got into your clothes and stayed with you. It wasn't conducive to prayer. There were no kneelers. There were just noisy kind of chairs. And almost, I found that atmosphere in the church sickening. And where I'd say I'd come from Rose Bay, where there's a magnificent chapel, and everything there is conducive to quiet and prayer. So that's all I was going to say there.
Okay, so you can relax your papers.
Okay.
And I'll explore a bit of that with you. Okay, so that's... So, barren, talk about... So, flat?
Yes.
So what, you were only, let's just explore that space, which is a quadrangle.
Yes.
To three buildings. That is your space for how long? And maybe talk about, just think about, and bring in that story about the candles and prayer in the heat.
Mm.
And, yeah, and just how you coped. Like, what is, how do you cope with that limitation emotionally?
Just, I think it was total acceptance. There were difficulties, and for example, that Mother McGuinness, who went onto the playground for about 10 minutes of a morning, the cook used to provide orange juice for her, and so she could have an orange juice. The rest of us didn't get orange juice. We had a glass of water only at meal times. And then Fleur and I used to get up at night and go and get an orange drink and fill it up with water and put it back into the fridge. So by the end of the week, she was drinking water and not orange juice. And we had, so that I guess there were little escapades that you know, brightened the day. In a strange way, we were very, very happy. It was fun. It was difficult. Two people had to sleep in the room where we used to have our meals. So they had to roll up their beds and whatever and make the room ready for breakfast or for tea. And then they could get ready and go to bed in the same room. I suppose the only time I really felt confined was Fleur and I were putting out the garbage bin. And we put the garbage out in front of the house, and we ran down the street, and there's a little laneway before you get to Maxwell Avenue, which comes back onto Gabo Crescent. And we ran up that, and we ran down Gabo Crescent, and came in the back door of the convent to be met by Mother Jane Goulding, who said, "You have broken enclosure, and I will report this to Rome." So we hung on in the wondering if we were still in or out, and nothing happened. So whether she never reported us or not, but it was considered very serious that we had broken that square. But I think there was a need in us to just to expand, to get out, to do something, and that was probably the naughtiest thing we could think of to do.
And the candles, when you...
Yes, well, we had, because of our prayer life, we had to have adoration before the Blessed Sacrament. That means two of us knelt before the Blessed Sacrament, usually, I think mainly Sunday, I think. We kept it going all Sunday. So two people would be there, and then after half an hour, they'd be replaced by two others. And we knelt there in the heat, in those, and all we did really is watch the candles that bent over and melted away, because they too were too hot to be lit all day in our little chapel. That chapel became Father's pool room later.
What sort of resources did you have when you arrived at the school?
That's a very good question. We had absolutely nothing. Some of the children had, most of the children except the kinders had come from other schools, so they had different readers. And it was hard to find something that they hadn't already, someone in the class hadn't already said, "Oh, we've done that before." So we started Words in Colour, which no one else had done, which was a reading method. And we did Cuisenaire rods, which was also new at that time. The children at Rose Bay gave us a book called My Way to God, which was a program for religious education. And we used that book for art, for maths, counting how many words were on each page and that sort of thing, multiplying it by 20. And that was our main material. I can remember when we got our first tape recorder. It was Mr. Donnelly. He had won it at the pub and came down with a tape recorder and gave it to the school, and we thought we were Christmas. That went from classroom to classroom with tapes or music or whatever we could manage. I told you I failed in music, but I played the guitar a little bit, and so people sang along. I played very poorly the organ in the church, which was a pedal organ, which used to walk away from you the harder you pedaled. And so, yes, and we sang and we arranged concerts. Now, we were really happy with those concerts, putting on a concert for the parents at the end of the year. I think I grew, I thought...
Sorry, but I'm just laughing. You weren't too happy at the Fair Maidens in HMAS Pinafore that night.
What did you do?
You said you're all... anyway, at the end of the middle of the act, you came out and you said you all look like basically a sack of potatoes on stage. Just wake up to yourselves.
But that bonded us. Everyone in the school was in those concerts. No one was left out. And...
Where did you get these creative ideas? Like, how did you plan the first... Like, you know, your planning. Talk about your processes. You obviously have many skills to think about this efficient use of things under resources.
Mm.
And to maybe talk about going to the tip for craft.
Yes, we went to the tip across the road
we'll get
ice cream containers or egg cartons and things like that.
So
yes.
We might just talk about that again. I just cut into that grab. But and just talking about your process, how you became principal, how... You couldn't do certain things. I know that. And you got some nun to show you how to do a roll. Like, just talk, that's just that kind of starting stuff. And
well, as you know, Therese, I'd always been at boarding school. So day school responsibility. I'd been at a day school at Braybrook, but I didn't have the responsibility for the running of it or the organising or the curriculum. I had no idea I was being made principal. I was at Barraburn at Rose Bay in junior school, and we knew we were going to make a foundation at Sadler, and it was offered that there could be a picnic at Sadler, and two cars were going out to the picnic, or one, I'm not too sure. And I put my name up, but I was not chosen to go. And Mother Barlow at that time said to me, oh, you're not going to Sadler. You'll have plenty of time to see it. And I said, will I? And she said, yes, you're the new principal. And I said, well, nobody told me. And she said, well, you are, and you go just before Christmas. That was how I knew I was going. You are right, I would never have survived without the Sisters of Charity, who were all around in Liverpool, and Bonnie Rigg, who told me, Sister St. Jude rang one day and said, the Catholic Education Office is hunting down your rolls. And I said, oh, we don't sell rolls, we only have sandwiches. And she said, no, I mean your attendance rolls. Well, I hadn't done any, neither had anybody else on the staff. And so we had to imagine how many children were at school on certain days and tick them off till we got ourselves up to date. I'd never heard of school money, and that one of the ladies did that, school money, for me. So I think it was a very steep learning curve for me. And fortunately, I think that... there was another good sister at Cabramatta that helped me considerably. So those were initiatives. it's hard to think, but it's like this group of sisters were sent to Sadler, and that's it. You make the best you can of the, you live your life. Yes. And we didn't have much contact with anyone else.
Can you talk about who went there, the six? Who were they?
Jane Goulding.
And describe a little bit about them in terms of your opinion.
And Jane Goulding, who was not the superior but acted as, and was not a teacher. And Mother McGuinness, who was the superior but was in early stages of dementia. Evelyn Stewart, a English woman who had been a teacher and an inspector of schools in England, then entered the our religious order as a lay sister. But because she was a teacher and had qualifications for what the Catholic Education Office wanted, she was chosen to go to Sadler. Mary Darcy, also... Mary Darcy, I'm trying to think... Mary Darcy. Another sister who was the cook, and myself. We were the first six. That's okay. Smith. Anyway, she's died since, but she was the cook. So there were three out in the convent, and there were three out teaching through the back vents. Then Fleur came, and Pat Ormisher came. Sister Corwell, I suppose I should be saying. Sister Corwell came, and Sister Ormisher came. And
I just interject. I spoke to Fleur on the phone. She said, I can't remember who you are. I was shattered. I thought, you should know who I am, sister. Sure. She said, I really don't know who you are. But and I said, so that's all right. You'll know me. You might know me when you see me.
Yeah.
But anyway, just...
Well, yes. So, and then the next two, which made it eight, were Fleur and Pat Ormisher. Now, I think that Pat and Fleur and myself did develop a curriculum together and tried to make a series of policies and, I suppose, philosophies that children would not have something, well, in religion, the Good Shepherd every year. There would be different aspects to the religious life, the religious teaching each year. The same thing with our maths program and the same thing with the reading that we tried. I think, see, Fleur's very, very creative. And she was the one who used to just go and get the egg cartons or ask for them to be delivered or whatever. Or we used to root in what was our land, which was the garbage. And see, where the church is now, that was a rubbish tip too. So there were always things being left there, and we gathered those up and used them for art and craft. And Fleur was excellent at doing that kind of wonderful... she'd put on puppet shows and things like that to keep the children interested a bit.
What was your first impression of the children?
Oh, I think they were eager. Most of them were eager to learn. Most of them. There was a couple of little fellows that weren't too keen. I think they were eager to learn and they were happy and full of life. So I think that, yes, we wanted to be able to expand into some kind of sports and that sort of thing because there was so much energy around. I think they were very talented. There were a lot that had very good ears for music and that. There was... people like I can't think of her name, Shirley Austin's daughter, and I think she was only in kinder or something, but she could read absolutely anything you put in front of her. And so there was this talent that needed to be tapped in some way. I thought that a lot of them were gifted. I think that the parents were extremely generous. And I think that's one of the things that struck me was, and particularly your own mother, I suppose, the laughter. You could hear people laughing as they dropped their children off and they were talking in the playground or something like that. And there was a sense of, this is jolly tough and hard. I mean, they had not even footpaths to walk up going home. And when we first went there, I think Busby and ourselves were the only two that had telephones in the area. So there was a sense of, well, it's a bit like Obama at this moment. Yes, we can. Yes, we can make, and I think Father Muldoon couldn't be more supportive. We were so fortunate to have someone who understood us, who supported us. I was physically sick every time I went to a P&F meeting. And I don't know what's there now, but I could show you the lily pond where the lilies growing there, where I was actively ill going to a P&F meeting, because I was frightened of some of those men asking questions like, why can't the kids come home for lunch? Well, I didn't know why they couldn't come home for lunch, but the decision was that they didn't. And so after a while, no, it took me a long, long time to be able to just go to those meetings in a relaxed fashion. I was frightened that they would find out I knew nothing about primary schools.
But yet it was an extraordinary school. Why was that?
Sense of community. I think that we did it together. I don't think any one person's responsible. I think that there was this sense in the community outside. If someone was having a baby, somebody else would look after their children. If someone had too much fruit, they'd share it round. Well, it was the same thing in our convent. If somebody couldn't teach a certain thing, somebody else would help them and do it. And so before even it was arranged that, you know, you could swap teachers in classes, we were doing that right from the beginning, because somebody had more skills in maths than somebody else, and somebody was more creative, like Fleur, were doing all the art and craft up and down those classrooms, and I was trying to do the music up and down. So, I think that sense of, here's a challenge, and that we can do it together. And I think the decision to make Simplex Caritas, simply love, as the motto, is very significant, because that's all we had. We had love for each other, no matter where we lived or who we were. And that love is epitomized in acceptance. Not that you're going to throw your arms around people, but you understand them and you love them and you accept them. And you think, oh, well, that's so-and-so, you know. That's the way she behaves. That's the way she lives. So I think the community aspect was the most important, and the ability to share.
Was it confusing how the media were painting the community and your experience in the community, with the community?
Did I tell you that my story about not being able to get the grey stockings? Yeah. Okay, we used to order our clothes as needed from Mark Foy's, and there was a certain man there who knew, used to come to Rose Bay and bring the shoes and the stockings, and they'd just be given to us, that underclothes we needed. We ran out of grey Lyle stockings that we had to wear, and I rang Mark Foy's and said, I was Mother McMahon in those days. Oh yes, Mother McMahon. And then I said I want to put in an order for grey stockings, no problem at all. So where are you, Mother? And I said, at 125 Cartwright Avenue, Sadler. Just one moment, please. I think I was put through to about three, at least three different people, and they would not give me any the grey stockings, because where we lived, we had no credit. And I thought, this is what everybody goes through. But to get those grey stockings, I had to get that man to deliver them to Rose Bay, and somebody post them out to us later. So I knew what other people were going through. You know, people couldn't order, that we had no shops there. Woolies came a bit later. The pub was the only thing to begin with, and I think there was a Commonwealth Bank up there, just an agency.
That's all right, I just... Oh, they're noisy, aren't they?
Who are they?
Okay.
Yeah.
What about the post office? Oh, we don't need...
Yes, that's right. There was a post office, but there wasn't a, you know, a department store. Or, I don't think... Is there one there now? Okay,
so...
No. Oh, but you could... You know, there wasn't any transport either, so people... I don't know how they got into Liverpool to buy the things that they needed. And so it was a tough life. But somehow or other, we had a roof over our heads, and we had people who loved us and accepted us, and we were all in it together. I think there was a sense of a new beginning, and it won't always be like this. We've got a sense, we've got the ability to create what we want.
So, how spiritually, how did you find the community, like the values within the community that you, or what did the community exchange with you? What did you learn from the community?
Generosity. Generosity, acceptance, happiness, tolerance, I don't know how to put this, but it's like, if things are tough, they don't have to always be that way. You can rise above this. You can come through this. Not just by yourself, but there are good people, many, many good people out there who will help. Nobody goes it alone. That would be one thing I think I learned. Friendships. Got loads of friends from Sadler days. And Manel, that you just saw, brought you in here working to help us. Her children were at Sadler. You know, so...
What sort of, like, Sadler is in you now?
Yes. Like... Yeah. I think I just look back on it as one of the happiest times of my life. Definitely one of the happiest times of my life. I think what I... Why it's so significant is that very few people have the joy or the gift or the grace to see what they've planted a seed, what's happened to it. And I've had that gift. I've started a school with very little and planted a few seeds. And what I've seen now is the flowering of all of that. I see a magnificent school with everybody having a computer through the school, or they've got wonderful equipment, they've got wonderful staff, they've still got Simplex Caritas as their motto, they're still producing music with their hymns, and we receive their newsletter every week. And then I look at those who went through the school, but to say people like yourself, what's become of them? Now, not many people see that. A few parents might, but that might be one or two children. I've seen the growth of hundreds of kids through there, and people that come and visit. David Knight with his three sons not so long ago. You know, they've become beautiful people. And I think to look at some of those, even Patricia Bunnell, looking at the way she trains her own children, that's an enormous gift and a blessing. And I think that's what brings back a lot of love and happiness for me, for Sadler, that you see the fruit of what you've sown.
The motto, I heard you talk about it at the reunion I went to, what it was, and you really articulated what that you try to instill in the school and children. Do you want to just articulate that here, if you can remember?
Yeah.
You talked about simply love, and in a spiritual sense, in terms of transferring that to the children spiritually,
yes,
and how we live our lives, and how not an expectation of how we live our life, but something about how we carry ourselves in life.
Mm. I think you've explained it better than I could explain it, and that we looked at certain mottos when we were looking for a motto. And all for the glory of God, and all this, you see, other orders and schools have, labor and pray or something. And we were looking at what did we have. We had a school called Saint Therese, and Therese had a method called her way of love, her little way of love. She did small things for love. So we took it for there that whatever we do from love or for love. And it's simple. It's not going to be grandiose. And so then we thought, well, we can put this into Latin and look good and call it Simplex Caritas. So I think that that's all we wanted to continue the life of Saint Therese there, and her modelling of, not she wasn't a great educator, she wasn't a missionary, but she had a way of love. I think I'm finished, aren't I now?
Do you feel like you are?
Mm.
Can we just talk about one more thing about how you would...
Oh, why did I leave? Yeah.
But marrying the people of the night. That father would call you over to witness.
Mm.
Do you feel comfortable talking? Because I think that's... I mean...
Yeah.
And why?
Well, that? I think once we had established the school, then we had altar societies and choirs and all of those sort of things. And father at the same time was getting... was being an extraordinary pastor. He was an extraordinary pastor in that he didn't have all the answers himself, and that he could draw on others. And so there was a way he had a trust in people, and there were some people there whose marriages were never recognized in the church, and Father would instruct them. And not in any humiliating way at all, he would have to rectify that marriage. It had to be done in a church, and it had to be done before a witness. And so he would ring me at night sometimes and ask me to be at the back of the church in my classic black dress and witness a marriage. So I sat in the back seat, or I fiddled now near the organ, and he had the couple up the front. And then they were married in the church. And when they went away, I went out into the sacristy and signed as a witness to the weddings, which made it correct in the eyes of the church. And I think brought a lot of peace and happiness to several people.
Can we talk about what sort of man Father Muldoon was?
It's hard to...
And your relationship with him?
Yeah. It's hard to... I said he was a great pastor. You see, there are some that are people that are great leaders, and there are people that are most great preachers, articulate. He was none of those things. He was a simple, simple man who'd left school at the age of about 16 and had no further education. But again, I think he had great love for the people in his care. I did some things, I suppose, that I had a row with somebody who used to call at Housie because he was trying to flog some material that I think I was certain was stolen. So I wouldn't take it, and he said, well, I won't ever call at Housie again. So I said to Father Muldoon, I've lost one of your Housie workers, and that was really important for Saturday nights. And all he said was, the nuns are always right, even when they're wrong, which meant to me, I'll support you. Don't worry about it, but by Jove, I wish I hadn't done it, kind of thing. Lost it. As time went on, he was never a confessor to me in that way, but he was someone that you could run anything past in the school. And I'd say some of the things that I would, breaking into the church, people there, you know, vandalizing the church, I bought a rabbit trap. And I had it set, and I put it in the church because I knew the way they were getting in. And he made me take it away and said, no, you can't. Somebody could be maimed for life by that. I said, well, they're acting like animals. They should be treated like this. He said, no, calm down. Don't do those sort of things. We can't... So there was a gentleness in him, and I think I could have been charged with a few things without that sort of thing. He was always saying, no, don't do that. You could say to him, oh, if we only had a small table there, we could show this or we could do that. The table would be made. He would build in his garage and come across with tables. He actually built every shelf in the new library, in a library that we put. He used to work there with Brian Parker after school and make all the shelves. So it was like another hands-on, you know. Wouldn't think of him as father so much, but like I used to call him Fred. Fred, his name was Frank. Because it would be too informal to say Frank, so he used to say Fred, will you fix this, will you do that? And so he'd be there nearly every afternoon doing that. When he wanted to retire, he retired to this very spot, because I was over there running the retreat centre, and he thought he would be here for years in retirement just saying Mass. But as you know, he got cancer and died. So we didn't have him for long.
What year did he die?
89. Mm-hmm. He came in 88, I think. That was only 1 year.
Okay, so let's stop.
Yep.